Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
In fact, from Eden.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. It's always a good Friday when you hear that music. That's the music for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And we got about a million more weird questions that we could get to today. I think the supply of weird questions for Jimmy is endless, but we gathered some up, and here they are today. And Jimmy Akin, thank you for being back for another hour.
Yeah, my pleasure, Cy Kelly.
And we talked about Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. We didn't talk about the Jimmy Akin podcast at all, but Jimmy's got the week bookended. Monday, you can start with the Jimmy Akin podcast, and Friday, you can get your Jimmy Akin your Mysterious World episode. So what dropped on Monday?
This last Monday, it was on the Sign of Peace, and what we're supposed to do or what we're allowed to do for the individual exchange of the sign of peace at Mass. And I go through the law and what it says and then propose some options. One of them is not running down the aisle firing air horns to signalize your peace with others. That would be inconsistent with the principles that are established in the text.
But well, that's going to change my Sunday. thanks a lot, Jimmy.
Well, there are other options, and you can watch the video if you want to see what those are. Coming up this next Monday, I have one on the Book of Revelation, and specifically on whether we can figure out when the Book of Revelation was written.
Oh.
And I think we can. I think we can narrow it down to basically a seven-month period.
That's fun. I love your Bible time. I think I've listened to all the I don't want to say because then I'll have missed one, but I think I listened to all your Bible timeline ones. You know, like by a Bible timeline, I mean, when was Mark written? When was Luke written?
Yeah.
All that kind of, I love that kind of stuff. So you think you can get within a 7-month stretch when Revelation was written? All right. Check that out. And leave the air horns in the car, people. I didn't know that this was a thing that was going on, but knock it off, people. Get it together. maybe that's an Arkansas thing. The next weird question, Marcus, TX6SO asks this. What are your thoughts on ancient civilizations like Atlantis and Lemuria?
Lemuria.
Okay. Existing 10,000 years ago and ending up destroyed, sending civilization into the Dark Ages. The theory is survivors from those civilizations spread throughout the world and brought technology to build the great wonders like pyramids and temples.
Okay. First, let's explain what Atlantis and Lemuria are, or are alleged to be. Atlantis, according to Plato, is a civilization that existed in the Atlantic Ocean beyond the Pillars of Hercules that lead the way into the Mediterranean Sea. And so the Pillars of Hercules are basically where what we would call the Rock of Gibraltar is. And so you go past the Rock of Gibraltar, you exit the Mediterranean Sea into the Atlantic Ocean, and you're going to find this, you at one point in history would have found this island there. And it could be large enough to be a continent, but you're going to find this civilization that had, among other things, wars with the Greeks, and that ended up sinking. And so that's the idea of Atlantis, and that's even where the name Atlantic Ocean comes from. Lemuria is and this was supposed to be continent-sized, it was a supposed continent in the Pacific Ocean. And the reason it's called that, the reason it's called Lemuria, is because there are lemurs, you know, the animal, the lemur. There are lemurs in, like, on Madagascar and Africa and India and Australia, you know, around these different places in that part of the world. And in the 19th century, to explain how you got lemurs in all these different places, it was proposed that there was a land bridge or continent connecting all these different places so the lemurs could roam around on it. And because they were the inspiration for this idea, it was called Lemuria. Okay. Now, there have been a variety of people for over 100 years proposing that there was one or more ancient civilizations like Atlantis and Lemuria that ended up sinking, and then the survivors of those events moved elsewhere on Earth and brought technology with them that enabled people to do things like build pyramids and other important monuments and things like that. So do we have any, and even today there are people who propose that like 12,000 years ago, so like 10,000 BC, was about the time when this advanced civilization started. Do we have any good evidence of such a civilization? Now, you'll note I'm distinguishing this scenario that focuses on 10,000 BC from a similar sounding scenario known as the Silurian hypothesis. In Doctor Who, there was a race known as the Silurians who lived back in dinosaur times, and they themselves were reptilian. And a great catastrophe was going to come to the Earth, like they saw the meteor that was going to kill the dinosaurs coming, and they went into hibernation and periodically come out. And so a number of years ago, some scientists started wondering, well, could, if a civilization did exist millions of years ago, would we be able to detect it? And they concluded the odds are good that we might not be able to, because of how things break down and get dissolved and subducted into the Earth's mantle over time, that if it was really something millions of years ago, we might not be able to detect it. And that is called the Silurian hypothesis, after the Silurians on Doctor Who. So I'm not talking here about those timescales. I'm not talking about the Silurian hypothesis. I'm talking about an advanced civilization that existed during human history in the last 10 to 20,000 years. Do we have good evidence of civilization existing at that time? Yes. As an example, I mean, we know humans existed, but to give an example of a civilization existing, we have various monuments in Turkey that date back that far. There's one in particular, it's not the only one, but there's one in particular known as Göbekli Tepe, which is, it's sort of a stone enclosure that has, it has pillars with, they're not super tall pillars, but it has pillars with animals carved on them and stuff like that. It seems to have had ritual function in its society. So we do have evidence, and only in the last number of years acquired evidence, of a civilization that dates back to that right time frame, about 10,000 BC, and we previously had not known about it, but we found these sites in Turkey and they support that. So we do have evidence of a civilization existing that far back, but do we have evidence of an advanced one existing that far back? And the answer is no, because Göbekli Tepe uses Stone Age tools. The people who built it did not have advanced technology. This is a Stone Age site. We don't have any evidence of advanced technology. And we also don't, and we should, if there was an advanced civilization, like if there was someone comparable to us, we should be digging up their machines. Even if they only had a medieval level of technology, iron doesn't decay that fast, and the continental plates it's on don't get subducted that quickly. So we should have their artifacts if they existed, and we just don't have any evidence of advanced artifacts. There are sometimes people who claim that we do with what are called out-of-place artifacts or uparts. Like, for example, there's an object that is known as the Baghdad Battery that some people have suggested it was found in Baghdad and or near Baghdad, and people have suggested it could have functioned as a battery. And that, so you do have some people claiming that we have some advanced artifacts, but that is not what the Baghdad Battery is. I did an episode of Mysterious World on the Baghdad Battery, and it is not a battery. If you pour lemon juice or some other acid into it, you can turn it into a battery, but that's not what it is. What it actually is what's known as a foundation deposit. Foundation deposits are things that people would bury in the foundation of a new building they were constructing. And they typically put prayers and stuff on a little, you know, they'd write them down, they'd put them in a ceramic jar, and then they'd bury that in the foundation of the building. And that's what the Baghdad Battery is. So if you want more information on that, go to where you can get Mysterious World and type in Baghdad Battery and it'll come up. So we actually don't have evidence of high technology from the past. We have some impressive artifacts from the past. Like one is, we found it in the Mediterranean Sea. It's a device that's called the Antikythera mechanism, and it's basically a device to predict the motions of the planets and stars. And it's essentially an ancient analog computer. It dates from a few centuries before Christ, but it's not electronic technology. It operates on wheels and cranks and things like that. So it's also not what we would consider advanced. So we just don't have evidence of an advanced civilization in the right time frame of, say, 10,000 BC. And we should, if there was an advanced civilization there. So also Atlantis, we don't have any evidence of it on the seafloor of the Atlantic Ocean. And we don't have any evidence of Lemuria on the seafloor of the Pacific Ocean or the Indian Ocean. And the thing that motivated the proposal of Lemuria, even though it was a reasonable proposal at the time, has been superseded, because what they didn't have when Lemuria was proposed was the idea of continental drift. And we now have evidence that the reason you get lemurs in these different places was not a sunken continent that connected them all. Instead, it was that they're on different continental plates that used to be connected. They used to be part of the same continent, and lemurs developed and were all over this area. And then the continent itself broke up because of the different plates under it and drifted apart. And so you don't need to propose Lemuria now to explain why you get lemurs in all these different places. Also, we've mapped the ocean floor, at least in general terms, of the Pacific as well as the Atlantic, and there's just no Lemuria down there. We'd be able to see it if there was a sunken continent. And we actually have done that. There is a sunken continent in the Pacific, but it is not Lemuria. It's called Zealandia, and it's New Zealand is the top of Zealandia. The rest of Zealandia is below water now, but at one point in history, the water levels were different, and you had this much larger continent-sized mass of land that was above the water line. And so there are lost continents like Zealandia, but it was not Lemuria. And so we have basically no evidence for this. And the actual explanation for why you find things like pyramids in different places is because you have people in different places, and pyramids are a basic geometrical shape that is easy for people in any civilization to come up with. And you get enough enough cultures around the world, some of them are going to come up with the same idea.
Thank you very much. That'll take, well, Marcus TX6SO, we got to take a break. We'll be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The EWTN on-demand platform features 50 new podcasts every week, as well as an ever-expanding library of audio and video content. For Catholics who want to learn more about their faith, simply using their mobile device, computer, or TV, your favorite EWTN programs are available 24/7. Visit EWTN.com and click On Demand. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Questions for Jimmy Akin this hour. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And people get these weird questions to Jimmy. And we get to have the fun of presenting to them him here and getting to hear the answers. That last one, I didn't know that Atlantis was from... It makes sense what you said about there was this island there, and they thought that... And that's why the Atlantic Ocean is called the Atlantic Ocean, because... It's over by where they thought Atlantis was. I didn't know
it. Yeah. I haven't yet done an episode of Mysterious World on Atlantis, but I plan to. But notice some of the difficulties with the theory that was proposed, that this civilization was destroyed 12,000 years ago, 10,000 BC, and yet they had wars with the Greeks.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the Greeks weren't around then. That's kind of like saying the Knights Templar had a battle with the German army under Adolf Hitler. You know, yeah. We're just talking two different time periods.
Yeah. All right, this one is from YouTube Binge Q1P. Mm-hmm. Are there, as some people think, a race of folks who are inherently evil through their DNA because they are descendants of either Cain, the giants, or both?
Okay, so these theories, especially about Cain, have been promoted for a while. This played a role, in fact, in 19th century racism here in America, where people would claim that when God marked Cain, that this mark was dark skin, and that's how we got black people, and Cain is this morally inferior person, so black people must be morally inferior. And this is just racism straight up. And it's also contrary to the core of Christian teaching, which where Jesus taught us the two great commandments are love God and love neighbor. And that means you love everybody. No matter what their skin color is or their hair color is or their eye color is, all that cosmetic stuff does not matter to God. We are all God's children. We all automatically want to be very skeptical of this claim. Another reason to be skeptical of this claim is even if you take this narrative literally, so you think there actually was a historical Cain, and even if you take the flood narrative literally, so there actually was a global flood that wiped out everybody but eight people, how would the line of Cain be preserved through that population bottleneck?
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. You've only got these eight people, so and of those, you got four males, Noah and his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So even if you take all this literally, you don't have a male founder to preserve the line of Cain through this event. And that's the genealogical line. Hypothetically, you could have a little bit of DNA from Cain get through that bottleneck, but the line of Cain itself ceased to exist with the flood, if you take all this literally. We don't, even if some DNA did survive, we don't have any evidence that Cain passed on evilness to his descendants as a matter of heredity. Mm-hmm. Now, the line of Cain was not the best line the way Genesis describes it. I mean, you can point to his descendant Lamech, who was also not the best guy the way Genesis portrays him. But two bad guys out of a line does not mean the whole line is genetically evil, as opposed to you just have a bad culture, bad upbringing in this line. You know, today we have this nature-nurture distinction, and they were not nearly as clear about that in the ancient world, but you certainly can't say, because Genesis doesn't say, you had these two bad guys in this line, therefore it must be genetic. You know, that's bad reasoning. So I don't think the argument that any such race would be descended from Cain is plausible. I also don't think the idea of giants being responsible is really in play here either. Now, for reasons I'll explain. Now, where the idea of giants is coming from is there was a widespread belief in ancient Judaism that at a certain point in history, there were angels who went bad and married human women and fathered offspring, and their offspring were giants, and the giants did cause a lot of problems. They were bad. And there's, number one, a question about how literally do you take this account. I don't see evidence that this happened in, if anything like it did happen, it wouldn't, if you went back in a time machine, you wouldn't see it happen exactly like that. This pertains to the period before the flood in Genesis, and that part of Genesis is so highly stylized. You know, the church acknowledges that the early chapters of Genesis use symbolic language. There may be something this is really communicating, but it would be highly symbolized in Genesis. So I don't think you can say, well, these giants were intrinsically bad and have propagated their genes down to today. Now, the Israelites did meet some people when they came into the promised land that they perceived as giants. You know, Goliath was one of them. They weren't giant by our standards. We think of giants as, you know, 7, 8 or more feet tall. And the average Israelite back then was only 5'5". So anyone who was just 6, I would be considered a giant by ancient Israelite standards. And I'm only like 6 feet. So those kinds of people do exist. Giants of that kind do exist, but there's no association between the genes that give you height and the genes that make you have antisocial personality disorder. Not as far as I've been able to establish. So I don't think, to answer YouTube Binge's question, not only do I think there are problems appealing to Cain or the giants from Genesis or the later giants from the Book of Numbers, I don't think there is, to quote YouTube Binge, as some people think, a race of folks who are inherently evil through their DNA because they're descended from these people. In fact, I don't think there is a race of folks who are inherently evil through their DNA. Now, we have to be careful about what do we mean by race, and in its broadest signification, it just means a group of common origin. Well, okay, so what size group are we talking about? If you just mean a family line where people have, genes that promote sociopathy or lack of empathy or antisocial personality disorder, sure, there are a bunch of those in the world. there are a bunch of family lines where you've got some problematic genes, whether it's for the conditions I just named or other conditions, and they get passed down in the line. But they don't make people inherently evil. They create challenges that people in that family have to deal with, but they don't make them inherently evil. These are other of God's children who happen to inherit certain problems, and we've all inherited problems. And we all have to deal with those, but God loves us all. And there aren't any humans where the whole family or the whole clan or the whole tribe or whatever are just inherently evil. We have to, and certainly not because they're descended from these groups. We have to treat everybody individually, as this is something that Jeremiah and Ezekiel both stress, that it's the individual and the individual's actions, not their lineage, that is important to evaluating their moral status.
All right. Thank you very much for the question, YouTube Binge Q1P. Was the Cain theory that racist one, was it connected mostly with the slave trade and justifying the slave trade? Oh, that's where
Yep. Yeah, it's also stupid because for a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
One of them is the text does not say the mark was black skin. Putting a mark on someone in the ancient world like meant branding them.
Oh.
And also, the mark was to protect Cain. If it was black skin, the message would be, don't mess with black people. So this is just doubly stupid.
Racism generally is. All right, we'll be, not generally, universally is. We'll be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. If you're one of those people that, and there are many like this, like, I have a weird question and I just don't know who to ask my weird question of. Well, we provide you an hour, maybe, I don't know, not quite monthly, or a couple hours usually, to ask your weird questions of Jimmy Akin. And some people have done that. Next one comes from Ishmael Salazar 3969. Why do you think Jesus instituted the Eucharist with bread and wine instead of something like lamb meat and blood?
Okay, so one reason he didn't institute it with lamb meat and blood is that blood was a forbidden food in ancient Israel. So he wouldn't use that. He wouldn't say, okay, go out into your, go get a lamb, go to the temple, cut its throat, collect the blood, bring it back, and then we're going to transubstantiate it into my blood, because the ancient Jews would not have drunk blood to begin with. So that makes a blood for wine substitution reasonable. Also, lamb meat was meat, and that means it was not always accessible. Passover was a special occasion, and if you didn't have, you know, you can afford a lamb once a year, or right, at least have the meal with a family that can afford a lamb, or y'all can go halvesies on the lamb. So, you know, a once a year requirement is something that is much more manageable if it involves meat than something you do constantly. So that leads to a second point, which is bread and wine are the most accessible foods. You know, I mean, bread after the beginning of the Neolithic with the agricultural revolution, bread became in the Western world the dominant foodstuff, to where, like, by basically in New Testament Greek, the word for food is arton, and the word for bread is arton. So the word for bread was such a dominant food that they would use bread to just mean food. Kind of the way here in the South, we use the word Coke to refer to every carbonated beverage. You know, whether it's like, okay, would you like a Coke? Yes. What kind of Coke would you like? I'd like a Dr. Pepper, you know?
Yeah, right.
And so bread was the archetypal food, the way Coke is the archetypal carbonated beverage. Okay, so these are bread and wine are the most common food and drinks. You might think water would be, but it wasn't preferred. It was very common, but it wasn't preferred because they didn't have good sources of purified water. In fact, water purification technology hadn't really been invented yet in this period. And so people would prefer to drink wine because, even though they didn't know the reason, wine, and they did know about drunkenness, but in terms of making it a staple that you're drinking with meals as opposed to getting drunk, wine has alcohol in it, which kills microorganisms, and you get food poisoning a lot less if you drink wine. So these were the most easily accessible foods, and that here's where I think is the real reason that Jesus chose them. They were the most ordinary foods. And there's, I think, a theological lesson in here about God can take the most ordinary stuff and turn it into vessels of his grace. And so he can take the most ordinary foods, just bread and wine, and turn them into the body and blood of his son. So I think that's what's going on there.
Hi, Ishmael. Thank you very much for that weird question. Reginald,
call him Ishmael.
And I did call him Ishmael.
Yeah. Little Herman Melville reference there.
Right. Reginald O'Donohue wants to know this. Is it theoretically possible? I always have a strong sense anyways how Jimmy is going to answer, is it theoretically possible? But here we go. Mm-hmm. Is it theoretically possible for the saints to save everyone through time travel prayer so that hell ends up being empty?
Well, so theoretically possible means in theory, as opposed to does it conflict with data that we know from the real world? And anytime you're asking is something theoretically possible, it means could God bring it about? And because God is omnipotent, he can bring about anything that doesn't involve a logical contradiction. The idea of everyone being saved through prayer, and time travel prayer is a term that I use to refer to praying for events in the past. So, like, could Christian saints pray for people who were alive, that in their dying moments they would turn to God, even if it's in a way people around them didn't perceive? And so could they end up being saved? Well, sure, it's theoretically possible. Now, there are a number of potential challenges, and if that happened, then hell would end up being empty, at least of humans. You know, demons are a whole other thing, but hell would be empty of humans if all humans repented due to people praying for them, even if the people who were praying for them were in their future. But there are some complications here. One is that would also require everyone who is prayed for to cooperate with the grace they were given, because God gave us free will and he does not force our decision. And so on some versions of Catholic theology, like Thomism, God gives certain individuals an efficacious grace that brings about the person's cooperation with it. And that's the challenge for this view. If that view is true, then God could, in response to people's prayers, give efficacious grace to everyone in world history. The challenge is this doesn't really look like it's free will, though. Now, Thomas will say it is, but if it automatically brings about their cooperation, how is it free? So there's a challenge for that view. So I would say that even though, then there's a second issue, now that we're reintroducing real world considerations, many people are of the opinion that the church teaches that certain individuals in the real world are damned, like, let's say, Judas Iscariot. And Judas, I pick him because he's the best argument that they have, because Jesus says it would be better for Judas not to have been born than for him to betray the Son of Man, and they infer from that Judas must be damned. Well, there are, I acknowledge that is the strongest case they have for someone being damned. Now, the church has not infallibly defined that anyone is in hell, so you could, even if you think the church teaches that some people are definitely in hell, that's open to discussion. On the other hand, at least it's not closed in the way it would be if it were infallibly taught. But if you think that someone like Judas is definitely 100% in hell, then it would not be, and we're not talking theoretically possible here now, but actual possibility, it would not actually be possible for hell to be empty due to people praying for others, because Judas would have to be lost. On the other hand, I've looked at the arguments for Judas's damnation, and I agree with Pope Benedict XVI. His view was that we don't really know whether Judas was damned, and we need to leave that up to God rather than substitute ourselves in his place as judge, because there are other interpretations of what Jesus said or what Jesus meant by what he said. And Matthew flat out says Judas repented, mm-hmm. Even if Jesus was saying, yeah, he would be damned, he's presupposing if he doesn't repent. He's not saying, and Judas is never going to repent. And so I think that, is it hypothetically possible? Yeah, God could give grace to everybody, but they might not cooperate with that grace. But they could, in which case it would be theoretically possible for hell to be empty due to the prayers of the saints across time. On the other hand, there are additional barriers that this would have to surmount if you were proposing it as an actual possibility rather than a theoretical possibility.
And we will leave that there. We got to take a break. Reginald, thank you very much for the question. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Why do we need to pray? Well, the Catholic faith is all about communion with God. And prayer is the form that our communion with God takes. If we're not praying, we're not in communion with God. But we can get in communion with God really quickly by prayer. It's the easiest, quickest, and only route to connect to our Creator. And that's what we're made for. That's why we need to pray.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Oh, you thought that was all the weird questions we could come up with? No, no, no. We got plenty of weird questions today, and we got Jimmy Akin here to answer them. This one comes from Kyle. Kyle wants to know, do some Catholic priests perform remote viewing on people during confession? Padre Pio or the Curé of Ars, for example.
Okay, so here I need to define some terms. So remote viewing is a recent term. It was coined in the 1970s by Ingo Swann and Hal Puthoff, if I recall correctly. And it's basically, it can be used different ways, but it basically overlaps with the historic term clairvoyance. By the 20th century, the term clairvoyance has changed meaning over time, but basically by the 20th century, it referred to a particular form of extrasensory perception, or ESP. I need to explain that. ESP is the acquisition of information that you have no normal way of knowing. So you don't learn it through the senses. That's why it's called extrasensory, because extra is Latin for outside. And so it's information you get from outside the senses. It's not an additional sense. That's not what extra means here. It means from not using the senses, you still get the information. And over the course of the 20th century, it was discerned that there are three principal types of ESP that are reported. Whether they exist is another matter, but this is what's reported. One form is telepathy. Telepathy is information that you apparently get from another person's mind. Mm-hmm. Like if someone's thinking of something and you don't have any other way of knowing it, but you have an insight into what they're thinking, and it's not like you're calculating or guessing or reading their tells or anything like that. If you're genuinely getting it, like let's suppose we do an experiment with you and Missy, Psychalid.
Okay.
So we put you in one room, we put Missy in another room, and so you have no sensory contact with each other. And then periodically, we take a thumbtack and jam it into your skin. And then we monitor Missy's pulse rate and her other biomarkers to see if they respond whenever we poke a thumbtack into her loved one.
Yes. Okay.
And if she does respond, then that could look like she's getting the information, the pain you're feeling from your mind, because there's no sensory contact. You're in different rooms. Okay. So that is telepathy, mind to mind contact. Clairvoyance is mind to place contact, where you're getting information from a distant or hidden location, not from somebody's mind.
And so
like if I say I want you to view this target, and I give you a target number, and you start describing the Eiffel Tower, well, then you would be getting information about the Eiffel Tower, you know, not knowing that it was the target, through clairvoyance. And that's what remote viewing essentially is. Now, you can use the term a little differently, but basically remote viewing is the same thing as clairvoyance, or at least it's an application of clairvoyance. Then the third form, so the first, telepathy, is mind-to-mind. The second, clairvoyance, is mind-to-place. And then the third is precognition, which is mind-to-time, where you're getting information another time, usually the future, also possibly the past. So these are the three these are the three commonly reported forms of ESP. And so Kyle is asking, do some Catholic priests perform remote viewing, which would be clairvoyance, on people during confession? And he cites Padre Pio and the Curé of Ars as examples. Well, okay, what would it mean to be using clairvoyance on the person during a confession? Well, okay, it would mean I'm in one, let's say we're in a classical confessional. So if I'm the priest, I'm in one compartment within the classical confessional. And in the next compartment, on the other side of the screen, there is a penitent. And of course, because of the screen, I can't see the person, at least not clearly. And I could use clairvoyance to say, what does the person look like on the other side of the screen? That's a distant or hidden thing for me. But that's all I could get. Mm-hmm. If I'm using clairvoyance, that's a real-time ESP application. I'm describing the thing as it is now. And so that wouldn't tell me anything about, like, has this person confessed all of their sins? So I would say they're not remote viewing the person. They're not using clairvoyance on the person. They might be using another psychic function that is relevant to the confessional experience. Like, they may be using telepathy on the person, and realizing this person hasn't told me everything. They're holding something back, or they've forgotten something, and I'm sensing it from them. So this would be mind-to-mind contact. But and to me, that's a more plausible ESP application that could fit some of the experiences that Padre Pio and the Curé of Ars and other priests have had. Also, we're leaving aside the question, did God cause them to have this telepathy? The causality is a whole separate question. But in terms of describing the experience, telepathy looks more plausible to me. Also, it could be retrocognition or backwards directed precognition. If you somehow could view the past and see, wait a minute, there was this other thing you did, that could be explained by retrocognition, which is sometimes classed as a form of precognition, but I think telepathy is more likely. It also could be what's sometimes called general ESP, where you can't really tell which of these abilities is being used, but something beyond what's normal seems to be happening. So I think if I were to explain some of the experiences where like, you know, someone confesses, I did the following things, and Padre Pio says, what about this other thing you did? And the person says, well, I thought that was okay. And he says, you could have asked first. You know, he's having knowledge of these events. And it seems to me that you could say that's general ESP, or you could say it's retrocognition, but I would tend to say it's telepathy.
Kyle, thank you very much for that question. Let's go to Jacob's question. Jimmy takes all questions. He really does. Jacob says this: how many bison have been sucked into tornadoes?
Well, we don't have good information on this. We have no, and I've checked, we have no reliable reports of bison being sucked into tornadoes.
Thank you for checking.
It's also unlikely to happen because bison are pretty heavy, so it's going to require pretty powerful wind to suck them up off the ground. And of course, that's not a problem for a tornado. I mean, you know, tornadoes are really powerful winds, but the thing about bison is they don't like being sucked up into tornadoes. In fact, they don't like storms. They're going to run away when they sense a storm or a tornado coming. And so it's unlikely to happen for that reason, which may be part of why we don't have any reliable records of it happening. I would say that it is possible there were bison in the past, back when we had big, huge, enormous herds of bison here in North America. Because they were all packed in together, they might not have been able to run away fast enough. And maybe back then, some of them got sucked up into a tornado. But at least today, we don't have any reliable records of it happening.
But gosh, thanks for asking, Jacob. Thanks very much. What an opportunity for us. OMY323 asks this: is the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament Jesus?
The answer to this is a subject of debate. And I hesitate to come down super firmly on any side. If you look across the canon of Scripture, there are a number of references to an angel of the Lord or the angel of the Lord in Greek, where it is clearly not Jesus. On the other hand, when you look at the Old Testament in particular, there are a number of references where the angel of the Lord seems to speak with the voice of God. So it'll be like the angel of the Lord did this, and then Abraham did this, and then God said, and the angel of the Lord is the only person here. And so it looks like there's a duality between the angel of the Lord is somehow distinct from God, and yet the angel of the Lord is somehow also God. And this fed in to a belief system in Second Temple Judaism known as the two powers. It's called the two powers in heaven doctrine, that there was some kind of duality with God, that he and his angel are some, the angel of the Lord is sort of divine but distinct from God yet. And this also pops up in common interpretations of Daniel, where you have the Son of Man being brought to the Ancient of Days on the clouds of heaven, riding the clouds. That's something God does. And so the Son of Man that's brought, or the one like a Son of Man that's brought before God, looks like he's divine, but yet he's also somehow distinct from the Father. Mm-hmm. And so, and Jesus then identified himself as that Son of Man. And so Christians have picked up on the two powers in heaven doctrine, and it sort of was historically a foundation for the doctrine of the Trinity. So then that raises the question of, well, that's how these texts, like in Genesis, which features the angel of the Lord, that's how they were understood in the Second Temple period. What did they mean to the original writers? Well, I think the Second Temple period interpretation of them, including Christian interpretation, is a legitimate interpretation. But I'm a little more cautious about saying that's what it meant to the original audience, which is what the literal sense of the text would be, as opposed to the spiritual sense. So I think absolutely Jesus is present here in the spiritual text, in the spiritual sense of the text, when it comes to these angel of the Lord passages. What I'm less certain of is that it's always there, this divine angel idea is always there in the literal sense. So I tend to be cautious here, but I'm open.
Do you want me to give you another question? We got about
sure.
3 minutes. Give you another one? All right.
Yep.
Thank you, OMY, for that question. This one comes from Larry. Opinion question. Assuming human beings on Earth are the only intelligent life in creation, if a total extinction event were to occur, would you expect time in this reality to continue on, our sun eventually maturing into a red giant, etc.? Or would you expect the general physical resurrection to be triggered by the last human death?
I would expect the general human resurrection to be triggered before the last human death, because St. Paul envisions, now he's not asserting, because he doesn't really consider this possibility, but he asserts that he indicates or suggests that there will still be people alive at the time of the second coming. So I would say that if we're the only intelligent creatures in creation, and if a total extinction event was going to occur, that the second coming would happen before humanity was completely extinct, and then he would return.
Wow, I was like, can we get one more question? And now I'm like, can we get two more questions in? But I don't think we can.
I can be concise when I need to be.
You really were on that one. So I forget who that was that asked that question.
Larry.
That was Larry. Larry, thank you very much for that question. If you go to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World this week dropped the 400th episode. Last week dropped the 400th episode. Mm-hmm. Today, the 401th episode. Tell me the two episodes again. What do we got for 400 and 401?
So 400 was listeners' mysterious experiences being analyzed, and so weird things that happened to listeners. 401 is on a couple of recent, very recent studies of animal end of or animal after-death communications.
Oh, okay. How weird did the people's weird experiences get? Was it pretty out there?
Oh, we had a wide range of different weird experiences. Nothing that I couldn't fit into an overall category and at least say, well, if something, you know, paranormal happened here, here's what it would have been. This is the category it would have gone in.
I got you.
But I also proposed normal explanations and said, wouldn't necessarily be paranormal because here are some normal explanations that could produce the same effect.
Check out each week, each Friday, get a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, Mysterious.fm, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. And you can get a new episode each Monday of the Jimmy Akin podcast, and you can go just search for Jimmy Akin on YouTube. That's his YouTube channel, or get it wherever you get your podcasts. That will do it for us. We will see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.